This is Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We are in the midst of a new era, the Trumpocene, and the first martyr of the fascist movements it's created is Ashley Babbitt, the woman who died while attacking the Capitol on January 6th.
It's Ashley who in some way gives the book its title, The Undertow. And we think of the undertow, some people know it as the riptide. It's those currents beneath the surface. The water looks okay. Things are normal. You're just swimming. And then suddenly you're sort of being pulled out and you're like, whoa, what's going on? And then suddenly you're really far out. If you've ever been caught in one, it's terrifying. And you can't make it back to shore. And I think of those as the currents that sort of pulled Ashley Babbitt to her death. And even more terrifying, the way so many people like Ashley Babbitt, and she's not the only one in the book, they find themselves caught in these currents, this undertow, pulling them away from the shore of a shared reality, and they decide to lean back into it and let it carry them.
That's Jeff Charlotte. We talk with him about his new book, The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War. Then we air part of an interview we did with Charlotte in 2009, about the increasing influence of right-wing extremism in the U.S. military. And finally, a review of Dennis Lehane's new novel, Small Mercies. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour, on this station and at writersvoice.net. Jeff Charlotte has long been an astute observer of the rise of the Christian right in America. His book, The Family, revealed the long but implacable penetration of our central institutions, the state, the military, the courts, by fundamentalist billionaires of the Christian right. Now, in his new book, The Undertow, Charlotte examines the spread of right-wing ideology among the masses and the new fascist movement it spurred. He calls this era the Trumpocene, with its miasma of conspiracy mongering, white supremacy, and hatred of anything resembling true governance. But Charlotte is not without compassion for the foot soldiers of the Trumpocene. He understands how its roots lie partially in the failure of the leaders of both political parties to serve the needs of the people they're supposed to represent. The other cause, of course, lies at the heart of America's original sin, racial injustice. This combustible mixture powers the fascism that threatens our imperfect democracy. The Undertow offers us an unflinching look into the Trumpocene's crucible, because, as Charlotte tells us in our conversation with him, fascism has a very terrible gravity that we must contend with if we are to stop it. Jeff Charlotte is a journalist and best-selling author or editor of 7 books. He teaches creative writing at Dartmouth College. You know, I've always pronounced your name as Jeff Charlotte. Is that correct?
Yep. You know, it's a weird name. It's a Hebrew acronym for Shin Resh Lamed Tov, which means, I can't remember the words, peace be to all who study the Torah. At that moment when Russian Jews were allowed to choose their name, they were required to choose a surname, which is why there's so many golds and so on. Like, well, I don't have any, but wouldn't it be great? And greens and blacks, people just choose a color. And some ancestor just like went for broke with that name, like, and made an acronym.
Well, that's great. Well, welcome back to Writer's Voice after such a long time.
Yeah, it's great to be talking with you, Francesca.
And now you, as you just indicated, you actually came from a very interesting religious background. Your mother was from a Pentecostal Christian family, is that correct?
Yeah, a Tennessee sort of Southern, in and out of churches. I remember driving to my grandmother's house, and you would go to, you know, here's a church, and then you go half mile down and it's another church, and its name is a variation of that first church because someone could not sit in a pew with that schism upon schism upon schism. Even to call it Pentecostal much less to refer to the Venn diagram of Baptists would be to overstate the formalism of the theology and to miss what has been such a main concern in so much of my writing, which is the lived experience of religion, which has so much to do with, not necessarily, it has a lot to do with rules, but more with how people interpret them according to their own circumstance.
Well, that's a great answer, because that's where I was getting to. And just to kind of complete that, your dad was a secular Jew. He came from a Jewish family on that side. So you have been covering the Christian right, however, for a long time. Why that focus?
So I began sort of writing about religion years ago. My first book that I did with Peter Manceau, Killing the Buddha, and which is, of course, a Buddhist idea. And Peter is son of a Catholic priest and a nun, so he's got his own kind of complicated religious background. And we were interested in the varieties of religious experience. And to be honest, we weren't much interested in the politics, certainly not in the Christian right, because I think I had a stereotype of the Christian right that a lot of liberal folks have, which is, you know, this kind of heavy set Southern man in a too tight suit, pounding his pulpit, thumping his Bible, and or maybe a little more sophisticated. You got Robert Mitchum from Night of the Hunter, you know, the preacher in Night of the Hunter, and he's got love tattooed on one hand and hate tattooed on the other hand. These kind of caricatures. And I stumbled back then, and there's a real direct line from that to this current book. I stumbled back then into this very different kind of elite Christian nationalism. Was sophisticated, it was educated, very affluent, very internationalist, and very right-wing at the same time. It was not what I imagined, and it was my first introduction, like, oh, there's a whole world here. And so I was fascinated at first just by, you know, to me, it was, I mean, the continent had always been there, but I was just encountering it, and how are these people living? And as time went on, I started to have more that my artistic concerns were overlapping with my political concerns. And I think here we are in this moment now, 2023, coming up to 2024, in 7 years into what I call the Trumpocene, the age of Trump. Whether he comes back or not, he has sort of set so many of the terms for us. And it dismays me to see the lived experience of religion so profoundly misunderstood, not just by the fascists who interpret the gospels to hateful ends, but also by liberals who have no interest or grasp in the nature of the changing theology of the right and why it's dangerous and why we have to contend with it.
However, you begin The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War, with Harry Belafonte, who recently passed away, in spite of the fact that this book does center on Christian nationalism and the Trumpocene. Why do you begin with Harry Belafonte, who was a great warrior for social justice and is opposed to, you know, the kind of ideology that the book grapples with?
Well, just as you put it, he was a warrior for social justice, and you know, he died at 96. I got to spend some time with him in his late 80s. And what I know and I think is important is to understand that he was angry every one of his days. I didn't mean he was also joyful and filled with joy, but he had no illusions. He hated what he called the Hollywoodization of the civil rights movement. He knew that the struggle wasn't over, that the struggle is long. You know, the subtitle of the book is Scenes from a Slow Civil War. And there's a way in which Mr. B, as he was known, was in that struggle every one of his 96 days. And I wanted to begin the book with him. And I end with another more forgotten songwriter to sort of remind us that when we encounter these threats, it can seem like a crisis. It can seem apocalyptic. And in fact, fascism wants us to embrace that kind of apocalyptic mindset. But Mr. B's long struggle, and for those who don't know, he was just absolutely central to the civil rights movement and never stopped fighting all of his days, understood all his music and his art as part of the struggle, didn't make that distinction. That reminds us that the struggle is long. The long struggle is possible. We can take hope and courage from him. And I knew that on the dark journey that I had to undertake and that I was asking my readers to undertake, we would need to begin with some hope and courage.
I have to thank you for that, because for precisely the reason that you stated. You know, it is difficult to read just how dangerously deluded people who are now in increasing positions of power are. And I needed that. Not only the chapter on Harry Belafonte, but the one that just followed it also on Occupy Wall Street, to remind us, I think, about what true participatory democracy can be and how American it is. So say just a little bit about Occupy Wall Street, and particularly I'd like you to talk about the politics of the mic check.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad you asked that. Very few interviews pick up on that, but that to me was absolutely important. It was one of the older, the book is mostly post 2021, but there were some older pieces I wanted to include, and that was one of them from Occupy Wall Street, which was in 2011. The book sort of covers roughly a decade. And the book is broken up into three sections. And the first one is called On Hope, and each one gets a song. The first one is Deo, Harry Belafonte's Come Mr. Tallyman, Tally Me Banana, which he understood as a freedom song, a struggle song. And to make that move requires imagination. And that's what I loved about Occupy, was the political imagination of it. Having been in and of and around the left all my life, to see in that park down in Lower Manhattan, and to see what I especially loved was the free library. Now, we all have little free libraries, but this was a big one. This was thousands of volumes. Not the demands. There were no lack of demands. Who cares? I saw all these people trying to practice what you call participatory democracy. And a student of mine said, it looks like physical democracy. And they wondered if we'd ever experienced democracy. And I love that idea too. Democracy is something yet to come. And one of the ways they sought it, as you said, was with the mic check. The NYPD took away any kind of bullhorn, so you couldn't make announcements and so on. How could you hold a meeting with hundreds of people of consensus democracy? Well, they borrowed a method devised by striking workers in Argentina. And I love that kind of global inspiration. And one person says, they say, mic check, and so it begins. And one person says a sentence, and then the crowd repeats the sentence back, amplifying it in a ripple effect so that all can hear it. Now, it's slow going. And you're saying, that's not very efficient. No, it's not. Because their goal here, it's not capitalism, it's not efficiency. It is, in the most beautiful, real, deep, profound sense, radical inclusion. Let us all be part of this thing. Even if we have to have a slow argument about what to do about food preparation through the mic check. And for a while, it worked. And for those who say, well, it didn't work for long, I just remind them, and I don't write about this in the book, but I was there. The reason Occupy failed wasn't lack of demands. It was because one night the NYPD decided to shut it down. And when they decided to shut it down, it took them an hour. And they smashed things and they threw books on the ground and they tore books up and they pushed all the press out. And that wasn't a far right. That was a kind of liberal Republican, Mike Bloomberg. And that tells us again about the long struggle. But I chose that moment of loveliness and beauty because same reason. I wanted us to remember that the way we fight back is with political imagination.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Jeffrey Charlotte about his newest book, The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War. Yes, I mean, I was there at Occupy as well, and felt all that you did. And you know, one of the things you point out about mic check that I think is so important is that it forced people to repeat the words of that they may disagree with, you know, the words that they were in opposition to, so that there was a kind of enforced inclusion of all points of view.
Well, I wouldn't go with enforced. I would say because you could also walk away. You know, there's no requirement. And that's an interesting thing about all points of view, because as we come into the age of fascism and hate speech, and if a Nazi had gotten up there, and, you know, The other interesting thing about Occupy and why I did want it to be there is Occupy is a sort of the other world we could have had, right? To my students today, it's unimaginable. Students who've come of age in the Trumpocene, it's unimaginable. But also to recognize, and I think what I knew then, the history of fascism always draws from anarchism. It did for Mussolini, and it does now. There were a number of Occupy people who became Trumpers, who lacked maybe some of the systemic language they needed. They felt deep frustration and rage, and they let that rage curdle into anger. And, you know, here is where that word populism, which is not necessarily a right-wing word at all, becomes fascism.
Yes, exactly. In fact, populism in the American context was the unity of black and white farmers and workers.
Right. Right. And it's why I so resented the press for calling for a while. They've kind of stopped now for calling Trump a populist. He's not a populist. I mean, just by historical definition, he's not a populist. The policies that his administration pursued were not populist. Ron DeSantis is not a populist. They are. And I use the F word really carefully. And in the book, The Undertow, I actually say, look, I was wrong. Before Trump, I knew that there was pockets of fascism in America. In a previous book, I even wrote a chapter called The F Word, Fascism, arguing that it wasn't possible in America because of our fundamentalist tradition. Fascism, a key tenet of it, is a cult of personality. We were never going to quite switch out Christ for a worldly leader. Until Trump comes down his golden escalator in 2015, and I see the strong man that the United States has supported overseas come home to us, bringing a fascist aesthetic. Would it find its reception? It did. I was wrong, and I thought it was important in this book to acknowledge that.
Yeah, and, you know, in 2016, you attended Trump rallies to witness the role played by religion. Then you went back for the 2020 campaign, and I imagine that the F word is the one that grew bigger in that. But tell us, what was the difference between the campaign of 2016 and 2020?
I think there's three stages in the theology of Trump. 2016, the rallies I went to, first of all, I noticed they were very religious, but the press wasn't paying attention. They were stunned when he won the evangelical vote. And I said, that's because you're all on your phones at the beginning of the rally when he starts with the hardest right-wing preachers I've ever seen. And that there's something even more complicated. They're always black or brown men, which is to say a mostly white crowd in its own mind being inoculated against charges of racism through this idea of Christian nationalism for folks who don't actually go to church. Most of the people in the book that I meet, other than the ones I meet in churches, are not churchgoers, but they're Christian nationalists. They love the idea of the Christian nation. But what is the shape of that? In 2016, it's something it's something called the prosperity gospel, which isn't always particularly political. It's the idea that God wants you to be rich. And what's the best way? How do you know? Because look how rich he made the pastor. Your pastor drives a Rolls Royce. Well, that's a sign of its truth. And if you make a donation to your pastor now, it's the televangelist shtick, right? And that's what Trump was selling. I watched a pastor, a black pastor, speak to a white crowd and attacking the left for talking about race in America. And he says, there is no black in America. There is no white in America. There is only one color in America, and it's green, the color of money. And that was the promise he was giving. Vote for me because you'll be rich. Don't vote for me because I'm like you. Vote for me because I'm richer than you. But by 2020, it had changed. As we know, the pandemic, a million dead, not quite by then, but moving toward that. And it had become darker. And it was the QAnon. It was the conspiracy theory. And it was what I call in the book a kind of bastardized, Americanized Gnostic gospel, a religion of secrets, a religion of the initiate. The rallies were always dark. But by 2020, they were much darker. And this book really began on January 6, 2021, where we entered the third stage in which we are now, when Ashley Babbitt gets killed. The young 35-year-old veteran who was an insurrectionist and was killed as she was climbing through a broken window. And she becomes a martyr of the movement, their martyr, their movement. And we enter in what is a part of religious history and a part of fascist history, an age of martyrs, what the Germans called blood witnesses, necessary for moving fascism from a stage of mere complaint to active violence.
Yes, and this is The Undertow, the section of the book that is a titular section. But before we get into Ashley Babbitt's story, talk a little bit more about this Gnosticism. First, for those of our listeners who don't know what that is, explain it. And then say why this movement is part of this tradition.
So Gnosticism is an ancient Christian heresy. It's the path Christianity didn't take. If you've ever heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls, or Elaine Pagel's magnificent book about the Gnostic Gospels, a scholar, but very accessible. And it was an idea, a church, or a faith in which the God that we see is not even the real God. It's just sort of what they called a demiurge. That beyond that, there was a secret power. That nothing is as it seems, that in fact the bureaucracy of the church is very much like what the believers today call the deep state. And let me actually, if I can find it here, I'll share one of the most famous Gnostic poems, and I think what's kind of amazing. Now, Gnosticism itself, Trump is not a Gnostic, QAnon is not Gnostic, although a lot of QAnon believers believe that they are. They think they're engaged in Gnosticism and this a religion of secrets. The Thunder Perfect Mind, this very famous Gnostic poem, thousands of years old. And here's how they describe the God figure. And I think you'll recognize their imagination of Trump in it. I am the honored one and the scorned one. I am the whore and the holy one. You who tell the truth about me, lie about me. And you who have lied about me, tell the truth about me. I am the strength and I am fear. I am the one who is disgraced and the great one. I am godless and I am the one whose God is great. I am the control and the uncontrollable. I am the union and the dissolution. It reminded me so much of one of the best-selling pro-Trump books of the 2016 rally, which was called God's Chaos Candidate. And for those who wonder, how could evangelicals embrace this man who's so impious and so on? They understood that. That book called him a wrecking ball. They said he represents a different kind of faith. The faith that you see in churches now that no longer have crosses, because the cross is weak tea. It's now a time for a war theology. And that poem, that kind of set of contradictions, I am the control and the uncontrollable, the disgraced and the great one, that speaks to the kind of grandeur of the personality cult that Trump has built for himself.
Wow, that's powerful. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Jeffrey Charlotte about his newest book, The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War. What is so striking is that there is the mixture of bits of truth within the utter delusion. And I think that that is expressed also in that poem. I mean, after all, the church was a powerful state that was oppressive. There's a woman, Diane, who you meet in this book, you know, who talks about some things that I can agree with, you know. Corporations do rule the planet. There are conspiracies, actually. There are conspiracies that actually did happen. You know, when I think Malcolm X was probably, you know, a subject of the like conspiracy. So talk about this interplay, these bits of truth within the larger delusion. How do we grapple with that? How does a society grapple with that?
Well, yeah, I'm glad you brought up Diane G. Let me tell you about her, because, I mean, my method as a writer, when I go to Trump rallies, I don't go to press, where you sit in a metal pen and you look at your phone, and then I wait. I get my ticket. I stand outside. I wait for 6 hours, and then I wait on the floor. I want to receive it as they are receiving it. I want to encounter it as other people are there. Diane G was a woman I met in Sunrise, Florida, in Broward County. And I'm not looking to mock these folks. They will say ridiculous things at sometimes, and people say, you're mocking them. And I'm like, that's what Diane G believes. I actually quite liked Diane G in a strange way. We spent a long time together after the rally, just sitting in the parking lot talking. And she wasn't a stupid woman at all. She was she's a woman who spent a lot of her life. She was involved in a kind of orphanage type institution in Haiti that her parents had been involved in through her church. She had come to believe that her church was not really helping. It was more concerned with mission work than helping kids stay alive. There's a critique there. That's a real critique. And then she saw, and this for her was the turning point and the breaking point. The Clinton Foundation, set up by Bill and Hillary Clinton, had a huge Haiti initiative, and it was terribly managed. And they put a lot of, like, you know, young Ivy Leaguers right out of college suddenly in charge of vast swaths of Haitian population. They mismanaged things. There was a lot of corporations. There's a lot of corruption involved. Bill Clinton acknowledged all this himself. He said it was a deal with the devil. He said it didn't work. Now, you and I might have some language of neoliberalism and systemic language to understand that. Diane G didn't. That wasn't the education she had been given. She heard Bill Clinton say it was a deal with the devil. She saw on the ground in Haiti, these kids suffering. She's trying to save them. She can't save them. Well, he said, a deal with the devil. And she comes to believe it. So her diagnosis that, hey, look, the Clinton Foundation has done something terrible in Haiti. And that's true. That's, you know, that's well covered by not right-wing press, but actually by the left-wing press that pays attention to this. She lacks that. And then there's these ready-made stories, right? There's the old American racist story of voodoo in Haiti. And there's the new QAnon story of the Clintons eating children. And she's seeing children's lives destroyed. And it starts to make a terrible sense to her. It's a metaphor that turns concrete. And I think that's what happens so often with people who see real problems and they don't have the language to describe them. And then a bad metaphor comes in, and then it stops being a metaphor, and they decide it's reality. And they're kind of lost. They're lost to the kind of common conversation that we once could have had.
There's so many places in the book where you repeat what, you know, the delusionary statements of the people you're talking with, and then you followed up with, this is not true, this is not true, this is not true. Of course, you know, to me it's obvious it's not true, but I'm curious as to the compulsion that you had to actually declare it in detail every time you repeated something that was crazy.
Well, I wouldn't say every time, but there were some where I've seen those facts go viral, and I think it's partly, I think, teaching. I teach creative writing at Dartmouth College, and sort of coming to understand, especially working with young people and understanding, we don't have a terribly broad common base of knowledge. For instance, many of my students have never heard of the U.S. war in Vietnam, didn't get taught in their high school. Many of them have never heard of the Soviet Union. I'll say something that here's the single fact that I agree with Ron DeSantis about. Ron DeSantis thinks the crimes of Stalin should be taught in high school. I do too. Stalin was one of the worst killers of the century, along with Hitler, right? And yet I see young people, because they know nothing about it, and they hear, you know, the ideals of Marx and so on, and they think Stalin is, and suddenly they're celebrating Stalin. It does become clear. I had a student the other day was talking to a man who told her, did you know that Hitler was Jewish? And so she just wrote this down and said, I didn't know that. I didn't know Hitler was Jewish. And I said, you didn't know it because it's not true. But it is a popular anti-Semitic myth. So you sometimes have to say it's not true. I'll give you an example in the book. And it's one of the most common examples. And I've heard people who are not Trumpers or not QAnoners repeat it. The 800,000 children a year are abducted. Now, if this was true, there'd be kids just disappearing like the rapture from every elementary school in the country. It's not true. What is true, and what's really interesting, and I write about this with regard to Ashley Babbitt, who became animated by this horrible fact. That's part of what drove her to attack the Capitol. She thought that the Democrats are stealing 800,000 children a year. 800,000 children a year are reported missing. almost all of them for a few hours. And then maybe it's a custody thing. Someone hasn't returned, on a visitation. Maybe it's a babysitter who's late. 99%. The number of children who are actually abducted in that most horrible of ways, and the ways that we think of like a grim fairy tale, in the hundreds. So many of these people, they do their own research. They come to a startling number. They say 800,000, that's horrific. And they stop there. This is not just the right, and I don't like to do both sidesism, but I'd say it's not true because I want us to think about the nature of knowing. For instance, I see all the time on Twitter and on the left, Elon Musk, the right-wing owner of Twitter, owns an emerald mine. No, he does not. His father had a stake in one briefly. It wasn't the major part. And we don't need that to be true. We don't need that to be. My problem with Elon Musk is not whether or not he owns a diamond mine. It's the fascism. In the same way that I always sort of want us to turn away from the kind of the lurid imaginations and say the problem is the fascism. My problem with a right-wing figure is not Congresswoman Lauren Boebert, whose grill I go to, Shooter's Grill. It's like Hooters, but with guns and the aptly named Rifle Colorado. Now circulating as all kinds of scenarios in which she's having a secret affair with some other major right-wing figure. To be honest, I don't really care whether it's true, because my problem with her is not who she sleeps with. It's the fascism.
Right on. And now talking about Ashley Babbitt, she's got a very interesting trajectory. I mean, she voted for Obama. So talk about her personal trajectory from Obama to Trump and what it does say about the larger movement she joined.
Yeah, I mean, it's Ashley who in some way gives the book its title, The Undertow. And we think of the undertow, some people notice the riptide. It's those currents beneath the surface. The water looks okay. Things are normal. You're just swimming. And then suddenly you're sort of being pulled out and you're like, whoa, what's going on? And then suddenly you're really far out. If you've ever been caught in one, it's terrifying. And you can't make it back to shore. And I think of those as the currents that sort of pulled Ashley Babbitt to her death. And even more terrifying, the way so many people like Ashley Babbitt, and she's not the only one in the book, they find themselves caught in these currents, this undertow, pulling them away from the shore of a shared reality, and they decide to lean back into it and let it carry them. Ashley Babbitt, 35-year-old white woman, Air Force veteran, killed on January 6th as she led a mob into the Capitol. We saw the video. There's multiple videos, actually. But there was one video that was on TV that day, not too long after she was killed. And we see the hands of the police officer who kills her. They're the hands of a black man. She's a white woman. As a student of American mythology and history, I know what will happen with this. This is the old lynching story, the story of that has animated so many lynchings, this idea of an innocent white womanhood. So I decided to follow that martyr myth in formation, and at the same time to research her actual life. And yes, as you say, to discover she voted for Obama twice. He was her favorite president after Trump. That in fact, for most of her life, she had really tried to be a decent person. Much was made after her death by people who call her a domestic terrorist, as she was, who say she deserved to die because she was a domestic terrorist, a belief I don't share. We don't just go around shooting domestic terrorists. I'm for rule of law. That, well, look, she was 14 years in the Air Force and she left it with not a very serious rank. What a schmuck. And then you dig deeper and you discover, why was that? She was the one who would look up the regulations, and when an officer was breaking the rules and bullying a fellow enlisted person, Ashley spoke up. She was known for that. She was a person, she saw a purse snatcher just a year or two before she was killed. She saw a purse snatcher steal purse from an old woman. Ashley's the one who chased that purse snatcher down and grabbed the purse. A lot of aggression there, but also courage. I don't want to redeem Ashley. I can't. She's a fascist. She made her choices. She died because of her choices. But fascists, no one is born a fascist. And I think it is important for us to understand and to resist that essentialism, which fascism wants us to embrace. It wants us to embrace you're either good or bad. Ashley did a terrible, terrible thing, a terrible thing, a traitorous thing, a treasonous thing. But when we follow her life, we follow the things that she didn't have the language for. She was deep in debt with, loans that should be illegal, but our Congress doesn't make them illegal. She didn't understand. She took loans for her pool supply business. She didn't understand the loans. They were unpayable. She lived in Southern California near the beach, just wasn't well off, just did it fine, had a little bungalow, tried to be a decent person. As we know, houselessness is surging in Southern California, not because the houseless are evil, but because the structures of power are failing them. She tried to be good, and then one day, a houseless man defecated on her lawn, and she just gave up. She gave up trying to be good. I don't endorse that choice. She gave in. She chose the wrong side. But we need to understand where these folks are coming from, because I'll tell you, in my travels, she is hardly the first Obama voter I encountered who became a Trumper. There are many more than people realize. They're not all white. Fascism has a very terrible gravity that we must contend with if we're going to really stop it.
And so following on that statement is, how can our democracy survive, especially because it is represented by such a profoundly corrupt structure of power in this country that is corporate dominated, that is destroying the lives of regular people? I mean, let's look at, you know, the so-called climate president and the liberal Chuck Schumer, who have just sold the climate movement, the struggle to save us from climate disaster down the river with approving the Mountain Valley Pipeline as part of the debt ceiling. That's just the current issue, increasing the military spending while slashing money for making it more difficult for people to access actual food benefits. These are the so-called good guys. How do we preserve democracy?
I guess I would suggest first that we start, I'm a writer, so I start with language, right? I don't think we preserve democracy. Preserve is something you do when you're making jam. You put your preserves on the shelf. I don't want to put democracy on the shelf. I don't think we preserve democracy. I don't think we have a democracy to preserve. It's also not something you have. It's something you do. That's part of why that Occupy story is there in the beginning. It's something you do, and it's only as good as long as you do it. We haven't quite yet fully done it yet. It's just as you point out in those examples. And when you speak about climate, that's another part of the undertow in this book. The sky filled with smoke as I would drive back and forth across the United States in the burning West, the floods. I'm in Vermont. Climate change is changing everything here, and there's a temptation, right? Because I'm going to tell you right away, I don't have a solution, but I think language can help us start to think of solutions. There's a temptation to embrace this apocalyptic language, the language of crisis, the climate crisis, the crisis of democracy. And I call my preface our condition. And I reject that word, crisis, because crisis suggests that here we are, that this is the final battle. That's language Trump's been using in his campaign this year. It's the final battle, apocalypse. Fascism always wants us to think this is it. Harry Belafonte reminds us the struggle is long, right? It doesn't mean that we can dilly-dally. It is always urgent, but the struggle is long, but also that we must live with our losses. I think of this book, the deepest undertow here is grief. It's a grief for losses. It's the losses of climate. It's the losses of democracy. It's the losses of the pandemic. But grief unaddressed, unmourned. Mourning is actually a hopeful process. It's the process by which we say we have lost something that we loved, and yet we endure, right? That's our condition. Because the crisis of climate, we're not going to say, boy, we better do something quick or the glaciers are going to disappear. A lot of the glaciers have disappeared, and they're not coming back. Those are lost, right? The crisis of democracy, it's interesting to me that the Republican never-Trumpers that I've spoken with are the clearest-eyed about this. They don't speak of any kind of normality, a return to normality. We see the press is filled with now, like, Biden shows that we can return to compromise. They said the scars of Trumpism are going to be with us for at least half a century, if not more. And that's assuming he doesn't get back in power. Real damage was done We have to live with that condition and make that our baseline for imagining. And I actually find that hopeful. I really, really do. Because when you start to think about that, you're no longer in the kind of frantic, how come I can't make things the way they were? You're no longer in your own version of MAGA, Make America Great Again. I can't make things the way they were. How can I live with this climate as it is? How can I start to think about maybe the mic check or new experiments of inclusive democracy that allow me to build, to do democracy today? I write in the beginning, I don't have the solutions. I really don't. This is a book that begins and ends with songs. They're old songs to remind us that there are resources deep in us and that maybe that those will inspire another generation. And I don't mean the children are the future. I don't mean that old lyric, but they're going to have to do it. And I am inspired. There's a group of kids I meet toward the end of the book in Black River Falls, Wisconsin. I'm traveling around Wisconsin after the downfall of Roe, Dobbs. Down Wisconsin becomes a blue state where abortion is completely illegal, reverse 1849 law. And Black River Falls is not Madison or Milwaukee. It's just a little town dominated by a church and a bridge and a river. And on the bridge are standing a group of young women and they're holding signs. And one says, your misogyny is showing. Another says, and these are not radical kids. They're student body president. There's a cheerleader named Peyton. And she's holding a sign that says, you'll forgive me. Or maybe you won't. And maybe we shouldn't. Her sign says, fuck off. And I said, what does fuck off mean? And she says, it means rage. Here is a cheerleader, a 16-year-old cheerleader. Fuck off to who? To me, to you, to all of us who failed to protect the rights, who failed to give these kids a world to come into. And how is that hopeful? She understands. She's not sitting there saying, it's not fair. You should have protected me. She understands. That has been lost. She's going to have to fight. And she's ready to do it. And she and her friends are ready to do it. And that's what they understand. I do find that hopeful. I hope they find solutions I cannot yet imagine. But that is the nature of solutions. If we could imagine them, we would already have them.
Mm. Wow, that's so powerful, Jeff Charlotte. And so is this book, The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War. This has just been such a profound conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Francesca. It's great to speak with you again.
Jeff Charlotte, read an excerpt from The Undertow by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, some more conversation with Jeff Charlotte from our archives. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Back in 2009, we talked with Jeff Charlotte about how Christian extremists are embedding into the highest ranks of the military. Here's part of that conversation. Jeff Charlotte's journalistic beat is the inroads the Christian right is making into the established institutions that govern our society. We've talked to him several times on Writer's Voice, first about his book, The Family, about the elite Christian fundamentalists who penetrated deep into the highest levels of government. His latest article is about how Christian extremists are embedding firmly into the highest ranks of the military. It's called Jesus Killed Muhammad, The Crusade for a Christian Military. It's just out in the May issue of Harper's. Jeff Charlotte, welcome to Writer's Voice. You know, I read this article of yours that you published in this month's Harper's, Jesus Killed Muhammad, with a growing sense of utter chill. You begin the article with an incident that really shocked me, and I have to say, I don't shock easily anymore. You begin with an incident in the holy city of Samarra in Iraq. Could you tell us what happened there?
Yeah, this was an Easter Sunday, and Staff Sergeant named Jeffrey Humphrey, experienced combat veteran, dedicated soldier, you know, not an easily shaken guy, was stationed there. He was guarding some special forces, a special forces compound. And the day began a little unusually when a chaplain came around with a video of Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ, the very sort of violent, militant version of Christianity that's a little bit unrecognizable to most people who go to church on Sundays. They started the day with that and then put the movie on constant replay, watching it all day. Well, sometime during the day, the compound came under attack. One man was killed. It was a very tense situation. It was a bad battle. They were cut off from the rest of the troops. Their ammunition was running low. And at this point, the Iraqi interpreter assigned to the special forces, who described themselves as the Faith Element, that was their call sign, he painted on the side of a Bradley fighting vehicle, which is essentially like a fast-moving tank, in giant red Arabic letters, "Jesus killed Muhammad." And then their bright idea was for Humphrey's lieutenant, a guy named DiGiulio, who I also spoke to drive that through the streets of Samarra, this tank called "Jesus killed Muhammad." And that the idea was that this would draw the insurgents out. And to help them, they put the Iraqi translator on the roof of the compound with a bullhorn and had him shout, "Jesus killed Muhammad," and train their guns on any responses that came. The Bradley did the same. They said they were able to track its progress because they could see the glow of the firefight that followed it through the streets. Every single doorway opened fire on this tank rolling through the streets, "Jesus killed Muhammad." Most of them people, ordinary people, opening fire with, you know, really tiny small arms, and not insurgents, in other words, unless every single human being in Iraq is an insurgent, to which the tank responded by demolishing, at one point, an entire block of civilian houses. It just decided, it just rolled it down, "Jesus killed Muhammad," turned its turret, and blew up every single house. The driver of the Bradley, Lieutenant DiGiulio, said that he thought the reason he survived this gun and run, as he called it, was because the chaplain had showed him the Passion of the Christ, and that had provided him spiritual armor, and that God had been with him on this mission to teach the Iraqis a lesson.
Now, how could something so harebrained, so dangerous, so counter to the interests not only of the Iraqis but of the United States, the Iraqis who we are supposedly protecting, how could something like this actually happen? I mean, was it punished by the higher up, by the brass?
Well, Lieutenant DiGiulio, the driver of the Bradley, is now Captain DiGiulio. So if that's punishment, he is going back for another tour. You know, Sergeant Humphrey, the man who first told me about this, and then I was able to confirm it with some other soldiers who were there, Sergeant Humphrey was a very, very rare soldier with the courage to come forward and talk about this kind of thing. Sergeant Humphrey happens, his own religious affiliation happens to be, he's a pagan, and he, throughout his military career, and very excellent soldier, he'd taken a lot. Because of that, he'd had superiors one time spit on his shoes and tell him that he'd better accept Jesus, so they're going to kick the crap out of him. And he'd really learned to sort of keep quiet about his religion, keep it to himself, which ultimately was fine with him. You know, he joined the army not as a religious cause, but because he believes in a good, strong defense in the military. So that's part of what compelled this guy to come forward. He saw this incredible sort of violation of constitutional principles and of just plain common sense. The "Jesus killed Muhammad" tank, both he and several of the men he was fighting there with, endangered them all. It turned ordinary Iraqis who, on other circumstances, would have been inclined to keep their heads down and stay out of the fight into active combatants and enemies. It's a little bit like driving a police, an L.A. police cruiser through South Central with a noose hanging out the window. I mean, You are saying, come on, you want to fight? You want to fight? I mean, it's saying the most fundamentally insulting thing you could possibly say, and confirming all the allegations of those who say that America is fighting a crusade in Iraq. But it's, by the way, not the only one. During the research for this story, I found accounts and photographs of tanks that would go into battle with crosses One had a cross dangling from its gun turret. Another one, the gun turret was labeled Armageddon. Another one was labeled the New Testament tank. You know, every one of these is advertisements for the idea that this is a crusade. And not too many people come forward to talk about it, but this soldier did. And I spent nearly a year researching this story, interviewed more than 100 people. The soldiers like DiGiulio, who drove this Bradley, and much higher ups like General Bob Caslin, division commander, former commandant of West Point, were only, you know, too quick to talk about their religious views and their idea that their religious views should be fused with their military service and their command of others. Soldiers who see the separation of church and state, like Sergeant Humphrey, mostly they stay quiet because to speak out like this is to basically ruin your career in the Army. Now, Sergeant Humphrey's since retired. He's done his full time in the Army, and that's why he's speaking out. But the reality is what he's describing, as extreme as it is not so much the exception to the rule, but in some ways it's representative of a mindset that's increasingly powerful within the military.
Well, let's talk about that. You link this incident to what you call a cultural transformation in the U.S. military. You say it's spearheaded by a small but powerful movement of Christian soldiers in the officer corps. So tell us, who are they, and how did this come about?
Yeah, I'm glad you noted the cultural transformation. I think that's important to emphasize. This is not any kind of conspiracy. This is not Dr. Strangelove here. This is a cultural transformation. This is a process that's been taking place for a few decades now, of officers being promoted on the basis of their religious faith, and then when they get into power, they sort of bring along other guys behind them, and they all think they're doing the right thing. That's important to remember. They think that what they're doing is part of the original mission of the military. There's an organization called Officers Christian Fellowship, about 15,000 members strong, represented at almost every major U.S. Military facility around the world. Here's a little bit of their sense of mission. I'm quoting from their documents. It says, "We need to press ahead obediently, not allowing the opposition, all of which is spearheaded by Satan, to keep us from the mission of reclaiming territory for Christ in the military."
Jeff Charlotte talking with us in 2009 about how Christian extremists are embedding into the highest ranks of the military. Go to writersvoice.net to read his article, "Jesus Killed Muhammad." If you want to trace the backstory of what Jeff Charlotte talks about in The Undertow, the current rise of mass movement fascism in America, you would do well to read Dennis Lehane's new novel, Small Mercies. Set in Boston in the summer of 1974, during the fierce backlash against school busing that was waged by white residents of the working-class neighborhood of South Boston, or Southie, Small Mercies is part crime fiction, part contemplation of the combustible mixture of class oppression with racial hatred. Lehane writes what he knows. He grew up in Dorchester, a community much like its neighbor, Southie. He writes Small Mercies with an intimate eloquence that puts the reader right inside the story. Whether it's the crackling dialogue, the exquisite detail of place, or the loving but unsparing character development, the novel unfolds like sheer poetry among the gritty streets of South Boston. I found myself reading it slowly just for the sheer pleasure of it. Mary Pat Fennessy's teenage daughter has gone missing after a young black man, also a teenager, is found dead on the tracks of a tea station in Southie. Her daughter had last been seen chasing the black kid into the tea station with three of her friends. Mary Pat's search to uncover her daughter's fate is at the heart of a story that sets her against the Irish-American mob that runs her community. But she wrestles with divided loyalties to her community, to her fears about what change like busing might bring to it, to her own sense of what constitutes justice in an unjust world. And above all, there's her loyalty to her missing daughter that propels the novel's plot. The other protagonist is the Boston detective, Bobby. He's from Southie as well, but avoided falling prey to its pernicious racism by the luck of having parents who somehow saw through it for the absurdity it is. As he muses, there were only two big sins in the house of his parents, feeling sorry for yourself and racism, which, when you think of it, are two sides of the same coin. That sentence sums up the toxic brew of grievance and racism that fuels the slow civil war Jeff Charlotte's Undertow explores, and that Small Mercies reveals the roots of.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.